Okay, welcome to the Hipsid podcast with me, Rabbi Simcha. And we have our co-host joining us from Edmonton, where she is quarantined with her mother, Sherry Barkley. How's it going in Edmonton?
You know, honestly, I'm grateful to be in Canada. I'm grateful for the space. I haven't been in Canada for about 5 years, even though I grew up here. But I think I'm going to stay. You know, I think I'm going to get connected to the Jewish community. Winter is no big deal. Life has not changed much in Edmonton. No one leaves their house here anyway. So the culture is exactly the same. So once I kind of got over that culture shock, I'm good now.
Sherry, we have joining us today, we have an A-list guest. Are you ready for the guest?
Oh, yeah.
Sherry, as you know, I am a D-list Chabad celebrity. So we have joining us, we have the A-list today. So I'm a little bit intimidated. Just to let the guests know, usually we record in a state-of-the-art high-tech studio in Bushwick. Sherry, what's happening to the studio in Bushwick in the pandemic?
The story is we can't pay the rent on the lot anymore, so there is no more studio.
Zoom. Okay, so we're gonna stay with Zoom for now. And Sherry, while you're in Edmonton, you know that I have this dream you should meet a nice Jewish boy. So now that you're in Edmonton, Sherry.
Hey, whoever knows the Gurmesians, okay, say hello.
We'll put a word in. Okay, Sherry, you ready for the guest?
Yes.
Okay, we've got quite the bio over here, okay? Like a serious bio. So we have joining us today on the podcast, Slumming It on the Hipsid podcast. This is akin to when Al Pacino made the movie Jack and Jill, okay? So we have joining us Rabbi Simon Jacobson from Crown Heights, Brooklyn. Welcome to the Hipsid podcast.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Rabbi, I am fanboy rabbiing out over here. Should I read the whole? It may take 40 minutes to read the bio, but we'll go with the short version over here. Rabbi Jacobson heads the Meaningful Life Center in Brooklyn. Rabbi Jacobson has been called a spiritual Starbucks by the New York Times. You like that, Sherry? Spiritual Starbucks is closed.
She's silenced.
Shocked. She's shocked over here. Okay. So the author of numerous books, including the best-selling Towards a More Meaningful Life, which I believe has been translated into how many languages, Rabbi?
13.
I can't even name 13 languages. Okay, you've appeared on over 300 radio and television shows, and you are the chairman and publisher of the Allgemeine Journal. Welcome to the podcast. Rabbi
Great
Jacobson,
to be here.
Honestly, this could be the highlight of the Hipsid podcast. I think this could be the moment. I think this could be the best guest we've had. Okay, so I did put a call out on Instagram for some questions. So if you don't mind, I'm going to read off some of the questions. But firstly, I'd like to ask you about your process as an author. And I was delving into your bio, and I believe that you were one of the Chayzer, one of the transcribers of the works of the Rebbe. And just to explain for Sherry that the Rebbe in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, would speak on a Sabbath afternoon for how many hours? 5-6 hours, I believe,
yep.
Rabbi?
Average, yes.
And those lectures were after the Sabbath were transcribed verbatim by rabbis, including Rabbi Jacobson. How can you possibly commit to memory 6 hours of a public lecture?
It's a very good question. I'll give you a little trade secret, okay?
Okay.
You remember how to brush your teeth? Do you remember how to brush your teeth?
Just about, but yes.
Yeah, I think I got it, yeah.
You remember language? How many words do you remember? How many words are you retained that you don't need to look up? Did you say a million, 10 million, 100 million, 1,000? A lot of words,
but
right?
That's over many years. This is in a single setting.
Hold on. Be patient. It's part of the process, patience.
Okay.
What that means is the mind has a lot more capacity for absorbing and memorizing than you may think. When we're little children, we already learn language. It doesn't take many years. We really, you know why? Because a child's mind is like a dry sponge. It absorbs very well. The problem with an adult mind is it's like a saturated sponge. It's a wet sponge. So it's filled with ideas. The secret to memory is the secret of listening and knowing how to absorb ideas and getting your preconceived notions and your frameworks and your paradigms out of the way. It's a hard thing to do because adults process. There's like two wheels in the brain. You following?
Yeah.
Can you remember what I said so far?
Toothpaste.
Okay. So one wheel absorbs information and the second wheel processes information. We adults, we process while we're absorbing, so we don't remember well. The key is to shut off the processor and just allow the absorber. And
I remember what you said, but I wouldn't be able to transcribe it verbatim. That's not okay. Exactly the same thing.
Yeah, but I could actually give you an exercise and your listeners an exercise that will help you improve your memory by 20%. How do you like that?
Even if we all have ADD now?
Yes.
Yeah, we've got a lot of millennials in the audience. Generation, what are we, Z, Y?
Yeah. We're not trained to know how to listen well. People cut each other off in the middle of sentences.
Right.
They don't respect other people's space. Listening is all about the secret to memory. It's not about brain power. It's the exact opposite. It's knowing how to shut off the brain and just listening with humility and modesty to another person speaking. And when you can do that, your brain becomes like a dry sponge that retains it all. The problem is we're processing. We're busy analyzing and trying to bring to conclusions. You know, when adults hear somebody speak, they right away say, oh, I like the speaker, I don't like the speaker. I can make money with this, I can't make money with this. We're immediately subjectifying the topic in relation to ourselves. The key is to put yourself aside and just listen. It's what real love is. When you love somebody, you just listen to them. How many children and how many spouses will tell you, my spouse, my parent does not know how to listen to me? You know, now that we're all in quarantine, people are being challenged to listen to each other in ways they have never listened. And so listening doesn't just mean you hear words. You listen to nuances. You listen to sometimes a little pain. You listen to things that are between the lines. And I mean, that's in short. It's a lot more complex than I'm describing it, but that's a key element, teaching people how to listen. And then listen and then repeat what you just heard without your interpretation of it. That's the challenge. So the exercise is a very simple exercise. You take any book you like, you open it up, one or two pages. The goal is to read it as many times as you wish. And close the book and write down on a piece of paper, not word for word, not verbatim, that flow of ideas you just read. I've done this with groups, small groups. And I ask everybody in the beginning, what do you estimate you can capture? 80%, 60%? Most people say between 75 and 80%. Then we start. The smart ones do it quickly. They read. They right away write down. Then they sit down like this. You know, they're all ready to wait for everybody. By 15 minutes, everyone is done. Listen to this. And then I ask each one to pass the book and what they wrote to their neighbor. And they evaluate it. I said, write down how well did he do? Nobody ever gets over 80%. And the smartest ones, the ones that did it quickly, get 40%, 30% to the point that people who actually write down things that contradict what it says in the book. You following? And I ask them, how could you do that? They said, because I didn't agree with it. I said, but then you didn't even hear my instructions. I never asked you whether you agree. This exercise was to write down what they wrote. It's not about your agreeing. Second time around, everybody's been humbled. Everybody's retention goes up 20%. Try it out. Because our minds are very interesting. Our minds are very elastic. Minds can be pushed to places you don't even imagine. We have bad habits. It's just like we may have bad eating habits, we have bad thinking habits. And when we have to listen to the Rebbe speak, I have to discipline myself to listen in a real way. It was the only way to retain it. That's one tip. There's more to say about it, but I just felt that's a good one to share. It's about the respect, really. Respect for the space and the thoughts of another person.
Wow. Sherry, I told you, A-list. You actually took me back to my time in yeshiva. You know, I was a late bloomer, Jewishly. I went to Mayanot Yeshiva. And when I first
The good news is you did bloom at some point.
You know, a little bit, abyssal. I'm still waiting for the full blossom. But when I started learning the Talmud, and Sherry, the Talmud is it's an exercise in rigorous logic. And I think I came to yeshiva with an ego. I was a college grad. And I would ask all sorts of absurd questions. And I remember Rabbi Kaplan would say to me, he would say, don't think, just listen. Don't speak, just... And after a while, once I observed that and kind of absorbed that rigorous, the logic and the flow and the pattern of a Mishnah, of a flow of logic in the Talmud, it really did open my mind. So there is a lot to what you're saying. And I think that when we give out, and when we give out of our own ego, you know, we're not able to absorb someone else's logic. So yeah,
right.
That really resonated with me.
That's good. That's good. That's good. You have a bright future ahead of you.
I hope so. Can I get personal with you, Rabbi Jacobson?
Absolutely.
Okay. So we're going to go back, Sherry, 25 years ago. I'm working in the film industry. I started to dabble Jewishly. I grew up, I guess, Jewish, I say on the podcast, Israelite. And one of the young yeshiva students from Chabad gave me a copy of your book. And people, they like to say you don't judge a book by its cover, but I'm the opposite. I'm a very superficial, I love pop culture, and I judge a book by its cover. And what drew me to your book was, it was the first time I was presented with a book, a Jewish book, that was really by an A-list publisher. The writing was A-list. The graphic design, everything about the presentation, it was something, it was very impressive to me. And it was a book that also dealt with different practical concepts. You had a concept and a chapter on youth. And 25 years ago, that book had a massive influence on me. I think it was one of the first books from an Orthodox rabbi to get that level of publishing house involved. What was the genesis and synthesis of Towards a More Meaningful Life?
First of all, I'm very touched, pleased to meet you in that sense, because when after the Rebbe had a stroke in 1992. As you mentioned, my job was to listen, retain, and publish his words. So after the stroke, the Rebbe did not speak any longer. So I was out of a job. And I felt my responsibility then to, in some way, convey and distill the teachings for people of all walks of life. Remember, these are dense, complicated academic ideas. So I sat down, excuse me. I sat down during that period, 1994, and I began to compile ideas. I always knew, I was always wired to the universal side of Judaism, meaning that it's not parochial, it's not just for religious people, that it really has universal spiritual and psychological wisdom.
Mainstream.
Right, that can bring a personal and emotional relevance to everybody. And so I began doing it. Then, right before the Rebbe's passing, which is 25 years ago, I was showing the manuscript around. At the same time, I was interviewed then by Charlie Rose and Larry King on right after the third of Thomas, which was the Rebbe's passing. And the agent I had a meeting with, Richard Pine, happened to see me on television. And when I came into the meeting, he said to me, "Were you on Charlie Rose last night?" I said, "Yes." And these were his words. I'm not exaggerating. He said, "You know, the meeting is over. Anything you have to say, I'm going to get published." Wow. So I said, "How do you know I can write a book?" He says, "You're a communicator. I can tell. I'm going to get it published." Within a few days, he had an agreement without a book proposal, without anything. He had an agreement with William Morrow. Today is owned by HarperCollins. And it was like meant to be. It was really a miracle. I don't know if you know the publishing business, but you don't get book deals like that. You need a proposal, back and forth, etc. But this was meant to be. I had to deliver a manuscript within a few months. This was June, July. The manuscript had to be on their table by mid-January. And it was, and I did it. I did it. And it was, you know, when you're in the zone and something is meant to be, there's a certain compelling sense of urgency and focus. And I was able to do that. You know, there are times you could spend 20 years writing a book, and if you don't have that clarity, you won't be able to. And thank God, the book was published, very, very well received. The publisher sent me on a book tour. We began in 20 cities. I ended up in 90 cities. And it was really an amazing experience because I saw myself as a bridge between the spiritual and the secular, between the inner teachings of wisdom of Torah and the mainstream world out there. And what can I say? I'm humbled, and I feel till this day that it was a gift. The years I sat at the feet of this great man, the Rebbe, and able to convey the teachings of Torah that's with us over 3,300 years to address. I asked people in the street, what are the 30 most important topics in your life? And everybody, what man or woman, whatever age, whatever religion, no religion, everybody has the same things. The children and education and love and marriage and intimacy and pain and work and aging and depression. So I wrote a chapter on each one of these. The book is broken into three sections, personal, social, and theological. So the personal is like things I've mentioned, the social, technology, government, women and men. And then there's theological things like God, unity, good and evil, miracles. And what can I say? I look at the book time and again. I say, I wouldn't change one word. It was meant to be. It was, I channeled it, basically. And there it is.
So the book essentially wrote itself. And it did have a massive influence and impact on my life. And just to get a little bit more personal,
I hope you're not going to sue me for that, right? You're not.
Quite the opposite. Just to get more personal, we are a shtickel mishpacha. I don't know whether you're aware of this, but my wife came to Judaism by way of your mother. That my wife was visiting Crown Heights with her mother as a little girl. And I think Chabadniks are very good at smelling and spotting somebody that maybe needs a little extra TLC. And your mother zoned in on my wife. And I think she was giving a lecture in Mill Basin, Brooklyn at the time, where my wife is from. And she used to learn with my wife. Your mother actually encouraged my wife, Arielle, to go to Camp Amunah. My wife ended up, and you should know the story ends that actually your mother and father actually walked us under the chuppah together. So we actually are...
Really?
It's about to go even deeper because we are a shtickel mishpacha.
And what is your wife's maiden name?
My wife's maiden name is Gutnik.
Arielle?
Mill Basin. No relation to the Chabad.
Wow. Group. I was not aware of that. That's very, very moving, very moving. My father's yahrzeit, by the way, is Thursday.
It's about to get even more moving because when I first moved to...
One second, I wasn't prepared for all this. This is like...
Get the Kleenex over here. This is how... It's like, you know, we get emotional over it. It's like Ellen. Okay, so, Sherry, you have the Kleenex ready?
Let's go.
Okay, so when I first moved to Crown Heights... we used to spend almost every Shabbos at your parents' home. We used to eat by your parents a lot. And I was very drawn, actually, to your late father because he was a newspaper man. He was a media man. And my background is actually in film history. And I really sort of connected the fact your father was very, very global. He was someone that read the New York Times. He was aware of what was happening in the world, but very devout, very spiritual, with a sprinkle of I guess saltiness and worldliness. And that was something that really spoke to me. And that your father passed, actually, it's funny because today is the Hebrew birthday of my son Eli. And your father had recently passed, and we actually we named, I believe the bris was maybe the day after, and we actually called my son Eli Eliyahu Gershon in honor of your father.
Wow.
So there you go. Me? Not wow. at all. Yeah.
How old is he now, your son?
He is
15, right?
About to turn 15, yeah.
My father's yahrzeit. This Thursday is 15th yahrzeit. Wow.
Right. So we're a shtickel mishpacha over here. See, Jerry, that's why she was up again. So, your family, your parents had a sizable impact on the genesis of me, I guess, on my Jewish journey, and really to this day, and it's a real connection. So I want to really thank you. I have a few questions from the loyal...
Have you stayed in touch with my mother?
We speak, sure. Sure.
Okay. That's good.
Yep. So I have a lot of very fond memories. So we have some questions from the loyal listeners.
Sure.
If you're ready. And on the Hipsid podcast, we go big or go home over here. So this is some heavy stuff. So really, these are some of the things that came in today. So I guess Judaism is very much, it's a communal experience. It exists communally, historically. How does Judaism survive under quarantine?
You know, Jews have been around from Abraham's times, 3,800 years. And we've been quarantined. We've been massacred. We've been round up. We've been isolated. Jews have developed internal resources for all circumstances, a deep resilience. And even when we are quarantined physically, we're not quarantined spiritually. So even when we're socially or physically separate and you connect to the soul, you can be wherever you are in the world and I can be where I am, and we have a connection. Jews were never distracted or confused and thinking, just because you're standing in a stadium with 80,000 people yelling and screaming, that doesn't mean you're connected with them. It just means for the moment, you're all yelling together. Connection has nothing to do with physical space. Connection has nothing to do with physical proximity. You can be sitting near someone and hate them. You could be a million miles away from someone and love them in the deepest possible way. So even though, yes, there's definitely true that Judaism has an element of communal, a quorum, a minyan, a synagogue, weddings, and other activities we do, but we never rely as a crutch. The social connection does not replace your individual connection to God. At the end of the day, it's a synergy that just complements your individuality. So though, yes, we're out of our comfort zone now, can't go to synagogue, we can't go to shul, we couldn't pass over, had to be very isolated, each person, family, or just but
can
that
I,
doesn't mean
can
you
just
can't
say
connect
something?
On a spiritual level. And that's the key.
I was an indoor kid, so I'm actually very much in my comfort zone right now.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, you want to stay there?
Yeah. I could just stay in this room the rest of my life. That's okay. Fine with me.
But you see the key.
Sherry, you're back in your childhood bedroom surrounded by nostalgia, so she's happy right now.
Nostalgia is not like what it used to be, as they say. The thing is like this. Getting out of your comfort zone is always healthy. If your comfort zone is going to a kiddish club or to a social scene, it's healthy from time to time to be reminded. I wish it wasn't under these circumstances with illness, disease, death, and so on, but it's healthy to get out of your routines. So I find the world is now, its routines have been disrupted. And what the Jewish people can teach the world is we've had disruptions, but you can't control events around you. You can control everything inside you, your attitude, your values, your love, your connections. So yes, it's challenging. Of course, it's easy to go up to a comfort zone. It's easy to just go to a synagogue and let the rabbi do the work, and you have your friends, your as I said, social club, kiddush club. But now we have to depend more on our own personal relationship with God and our own personal relationship with each other, which is a challenge. And I believe the Jews will rise to the occasion, but they will teach the world as well. This is what we need to do. Remember, the same God that wanted us to go to synagogue now wants us to stay home. So you're still dealing with the same God. It's just a different script, but it's the same connection. So we just have to learn to, you know, a good swimmer doesn't fight the storm. A bad swimmer will fight the tide and can end up getting exhausted. A good swimmer swims. And if it gets stormy, it gets choppy, the swim will just float. That's how you navigate. You navigate the vicissitudes, the ups and downs. You go with the flow. You don't try to fight it, because we don't control events around us. We don't control. People thought 2 months ago, 3 months ago, we had our plans, our Passover plans, our summer plans. I'm going to this. We had restaurants to go to, theaters, you name it. Exactly. Economy, school, there's nothing that hasn't been disrupted. So you could either sit and complain and be frustrated and angry and resentful, or you can say, step back and say, you know what? Smile, as long as you're healthy, and say, okay, how am I going to swim these waters? I will dig deeper, and I'm going to find creative and innovative ways to connect. Look, I don't think I'd be on this podcast with you were it not for the pandemic, you know, most likely. So here we are. We're here to connect. We're connecting. I would not know your stories you just shared with me. Beautiful stories about my family and our connection. And I wouldn't meet this lovely young woman who's in the comfort zone of her home. And so many other connections that we can make now that are even more sincere and more authentic than just relying on the security blankets of our infrastructures. So, again, I wish it didn't come with pain and grief and loss. But without that, this is a spiritual awakening. This doesn't happen. This is once in history that you have such a, the material world has paused. So, but the spiritual world has not. So.
You know, if you would have told me 2 months ago, I would have spent this amount of time with my wife and my children, I would have predicted a homicide. But quite the inverse has happened. I'm closer to my kids than ever before. My kids have less, but are happier. They have less materialism, less trips. We promised them that we're going to take them to Florida on Passover. None of these things happened. We're bonding. We're happy. Me and my wife are getting along shockingly better than ever before. So this situation has bred opportunity, and I think people are perhaps open to something a little less material and more spiritual and transcendent this time.
We created a hashtag: socially distant, soulfully closer than ever.
There you go. I think Cuomo says socially distant, spiritually together. So my wife has become a chassid of Cuomo. Every day she spends an hour and a half as if it is the Bible from Moses, listening to Cuomo's live updates. So I have another question, Rabbi, that someone asked me, is this a sign of the Messiah's imminent coming? And the fact that we've seen something on such a magnitude, and if I hear one more rabbi use the word unprecedented, I'm going to just like flip out, because I'm sick of hearing the word unprecedented. But is it rabbinical quackery to say that all of these biblical events, I mean, yesterday I saw a plague of hail coming down in May, or perhaps this is just a random feat of nature. Now, on the one hand, you know, during Passover, I'm reading the story of quarantine. I'm literally quarantined. Is this messianic, or is this quackery?
I think we should define messianic first. What does messianic mean? So I'll define Messianic as this. I'm going to cite Maimonides, and as explained in Jewish mystical thought and Hasidic literature, Messianic is not as exotic and as obscure and abstract as people think it is. Essentially, the age of Messianic age, from a Jewish perspective, is a world that's aligned with its purpose, that's aligned with the reason it was created. Think of a machine. You buy a computer, you buy an appliance, you come home with it, you have an operator's manual, tells you, use the machine right, it'll work smooth, efficient. Use it the wrong way, you'll damage it. Life is a machine. Life and the universe has purpose, has direction. This is the essence of what a meaningful life is. And you'll say, what's the realization of the purpose? Like, when have you reached your destination? Is to put it in somewhat the little spiritual terms, it's the fusion of body and soul, of spirit and matter, where the physical world is a vehicle and a channel for spiritual expression. That's considered a healthy world. That would bring world peace, no more divisiveness and war, no famine, a certain equality and respect for each other. So if you define Messianic that way, then I would say any event that happens in history that helps the world get closer to that alignment is Messianic. I would say the pandemic and the COVID-19 has painful elements to it. And that, obviously, we all are sensitive to, and I don't want to minimize that, because I know people who've died and families who are grieving. It's not a small matter. This is not a game. But as far as the global effect it's having, yes, if we use this properly, if we allow us to become more sensitive people, kinder people, gentler people, not so selfish and narcissistic, you know, dog eats dog, survival of the fittest, then there's no question that this is an opportunity to create a global higher state of consciousness and sensitivity, which is absolutely messianic without any, you said you use the word quackery. We're not talking something weird. It's a simple thing. It's like, you know, World War II was the bloodiest war in history. But following it, the world learned lessons. We experienced, I don't want to use the unprecedented, but we experienced tremendous amount of prosperity. So I think everything has to be seen in context. I think when we look back at 2020, hindsight, at the year of 2020 vision, we will come to see that, used properly, this disruption, using a Hasidic metaphor, is like the egg cracking before the chick emerges. That between every paradigm shift, you need to go through some disruption. Again, we don't want disruption that's painful and destructive. But if you focus on the egg, you'll see cracks. If you focus on the chick that's emerging, you'll see life. So we all know all transitions always will have some element of discomfort. And that's how I frame the events that are happening now.
Right. So I think similar to what you're saying, I don't see redemption, but I see something redemptive in first responders, in the way that we realize that.
Well said. Yes, well said.
Yeah, that we are all one. We're one body. The fact that our health, it affects everyone. Just like the Baal Shem Tov would talk about, a leaf can affect, you know, the world. So too, that, a simple action as a cough or a sneeze, what an influence and what an impact that can have, and how we all need each other. But I was thinking to myself recently, everyone talks about going back to normal. Like, when do we go back to normal? But then I think normal wasn't that great. You know, normal was a world of competition, a world of violence, a world of anti-Semitism. And I would hope that we could come out of this with a new normal, with a new reality. And I think that's what something that you're alluding to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we have that opportunity now in a really unbelievable way. I keep avoiding unprecedented, but that's what I mean.
And we need a new word. Sherry, what's a different word for unprecedented?
I'm going to have to consult the...
You've got to get the thesaurus out.
Yeah.
So, Rabbi Jacobson, we have a couple more
questions. You can say once in history.
There you go. Couple more questions. So I'm a campus rabbi. So let's say that you were invited to give the commencement speech for the class of 2020. What would you say to the graduating class who are entering the worst recession since the Great Depression? Starbucks isn't hiring or even open, and they're all in the same boat, and that boat is sinking. Not to put you on the spot over here.
No, I'm glad you put me on the spot. I would say that in contrast to all graduating classes of previous years, who really traveled on the road, most traveled, they were just walking on the same path of graduates before them. You have the opportunity to travel on the road less traveled, using Robert Frost's classic poem. I travel in the wood, and I see a path that diverged in the wood. One path was very worn out. People had traveled. And the other one was a road less traveled on. And I took the road less traveled, and that has made all the difference. You have the opportunity to do something pioneering and unique that no generation before, at least not in recent memory, had, and that is to chart new ground. We are in uncharted territory here.
Unprecedented.
Or you have the opportunity to move back home with rent-free, with dignity. Before that was, you know, there was no dignity in that. Now there's no shame in the moving back into your mom's house game. So there's always that.
But what do you do with people who have higher aspirations than that?
Well, I'm just saying it's a bridge. It's a bridge. Yeah.
Anyway, so I would say to this group of students, I say, yes, it's easier to conform and follow those that came before us, but it's more meaningful and it will be historical that you're going to pioneer a new path, which one means we don't know economic uncertainty. You don't know what job you can take, but you still can do things that can radically change the world. And I would encourage them to get involved in service-oriented projects, volunteering, helping those that are needy, helping the elderly, different higher consciousness activities, and demonstrating that the human spirit in 2020, the graduating class of 2020, found innovative and creative ways to graduate and to chart new ground, chart a new path. And that would be the gist. I would obviously embellish on it, inspire them, and that would be it. It's really can be extremely exciting because you're going to do something no one has ever done before. So there is unknowns, but an unknown should not frighten us. Unknown should motivate us to dig deeper and become more creative. I can tell you, I want to speak personally for a moment, okay? We've been speaking in the last 2 months, I've never been as busy in my entire life. I've been doing nonstop programming, and not because I deliberately chose, I feel I was trained for this. You know, we're in war. So just like there's a physical illness to fight, there's also a psychological one. People are demoralized. People are fearful, they're concerned, the unknown, the uncertainty. Every day that passes, we have no clue. Some will say, well, we'll be in a week from now. How about a month from now? Everybody has all kinds of predictions, but it's very clear nobody knows what they're talking about. It takes a toll. And I think there's an exponential impact that this disruption is taking. And this is a time where those of us that have been trained psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, is to rise and help people build up their morale, give hope, courage, strength. So this is the time. I'm not over-exaggerating when I say, if not now, when? You will never have a more disruptive and a more opportune time. People are vulnerable. They're receptive. I've never seen it like this in my entire life. I don't think it's existed, because even when there were pandemics in the past, it was never, we didn't have technology to share it with everyone. This is global. This is literally, you know, the Spanish flu 100 years ago, there was no travel. There was no air travel. There was no the connections we have, the globalization of the world.
There was no Zoom.
Right? So what we have now is 7.5 billion people exposed their vulnerability and exposed to their bare bones. But you know what? This is the time. I've been doing a program. I did a program last week. It was very well received. Can you be alone? Many people are afraid of being alone. Now, can you be alone? You know, this week I'll be doing a program called, what is it called? Quarantined and Addicted. Can I break free? Addiction is going up because you can imagine when someone's alone, quarantined, if you're in good shape, it brings the best out of you. But if you're very weak, it's such an easy trap to fall back on all kinds of instant gratification and short-term relief. So we've got challenges, but if I learned anything from the Rebbe, and I learned anything from true visionary leaders, which we don't have today, let's be honest, have taught us we can make it through. We will prevail if we allow the human spirit to shine. And we have to shine ourselves, and we need to shine, and we need to help everyone around us to shine. That's really what it's about. I wish every listener of yours, you, I, all of us, Sherry, all of us, you, Rabbi, should do it to bring the best out of it. We should not be part of the problem. We're part of the solution. That's the key.
Well, I think you should run for president over here because we need some clarity in the White House. Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Jacobson. You are my mishpacha. I'm your spiritual child. Your book
inspired me. Has there been a Jewish president?
Only on television. Sherry, we're going to leave you with the final question for Rabbi Jacobson. Stump the rabbi, Sherry.
How many Zoom calls have you done?
You stumped me. How many Zoom calls? I would say around 70.
Wow. Sherry, that wasn't the question I thought you were going to ask. I thought you were going to ask, Rabbi Jacobson, have you watched Tiger King in quarantine? He's pleading
I have to apologize. I don't even know what Tiger King is, but
that's a good answer. Okay, are you familiar with the show Unorthodox? Have you seen it, and what's your opinion?
I didn't see it. I heard that. I did hear about.
Okay.
I did see. The closest I saw was Shtisel, but I didn't see Unorthodox. I didn't. I'll tell you the truth. I really don't have time to watch. I'm busy, people watching me, you know, so.
I have a question, but it's a little controversial, so it's okay if you don't want to answer. Do you have opinions about the Jewish gatherings that have taken place during COVID-19?
Absolutely. The Jewish people, we have a Torah. The Torah is our constitution. It tells us how to behave. I find that some people behave recklessly, and did not follow doctors and medical authorities and rabbinic authorities. I'm not going to defend them, but I will say the majority of the Jewish people did follow. I mean, I remember I had symptoms right after Purim. We're talking about mid-March. I called the doctor. He said, you don't even need to be tested because if you're positive, they can't do anything for you anyway. And I quarantined. I just stayed home. I'm a public figure. I travel. I just stayed home. Everything that was that. And I think the majority, there are a few who either immature or in denial or whatever. I'm not going to explain it. Did behave in a way that I think was inappropriate. But it's easy to say that. The Torah tells us that when there's danger to life, even a doubt, even there's a small doubt of danger, you need to take everybody. You're not even allowed to keep Shabbos. You know, you could eat pork on Yom Kippur if it's to save a life. Because
a life, Sherry.
That doesn't mean you should go eat pork. I'm saying, right. Okay. The point is life. God said, preserve life. I gave you Judaism to preserve life, not to destroy life. So yes, murdering another person is not acceptable. You have to die before you murder someone. But everything else, except three items that are real cardinal sins, one is supposed to protect life. So a minyan, synagogue, anything. You ask any...
Is it the funerals? They had the big funeral. That was the big one, right?
Yeah, there was one. I don't understand why they did that, but I can tell you, unfortunately, there were hundreds of funerals and nobody was there. That was not reported on. But I've seen funerals where they didn't have anyone because of the social distancing. And it's sad because people want to shiva, you know. I will just say this. You know, in defense of Jews and defense of people, most people are very responsible and behave responsibly. There are a few... And unfortunately, we have had losses in my own community in Crown Heights a good 60, 70 people I personally knew that I grew up with are now in another world. And could have been prevented? I don't like to look back because, I'll be honest, in February or early March, nobody would have accepted a quarantine anyway. It had to take, unfortunately, some deaths. You know, because I remember Purim. We didn't think it's coming here. To be honest, all of us didn't. And not the government, not the politicians. I don't like the finger pointing. I cannot stand the politicization of all of this. You're talking about life and death. Why are we politicizing? People hate that, I believe. I think that's terrible. So disingenuous. It's so insensitive. We are in it together. There's nothing to do with Democrats or Republicans. And people trying to use it and blame. Nah. Listen, I don't know who would have done better. I don't know. This was definitely by surprise. America would not have closed down if it was announced in February quarantine. I guarantee you, because people would not have believed it. So anyone tells me we should have closed down in January, it would not have happened. Even now, there's calls to open up when we still have doubts what can happen. Anyway, as a Jew, as a Torah person, I will say we follow Torah. Torah says you listen to medical authorities. That's that. And that's what we should be doing. That's what God wants. Now, if someone wants to go to synagogue and not listen to medical, they're not doing what God wants. They're doing what they want. So it's just as selfish as anyone that's not listening to God. So I know you asked a controversial question. I was candid and blunt, and we should conclude on an upbeat note, because I've seen unbelievable acts of valiant heroism. Tonight there's a big Hatzalathon for all those for those volunteers. I'm a host on it. It's at I'll just might as well plug it. I don't know when this is going to be broadcast. It'll probably be broadcast afterwards. But anyway, these are hundreds and thousands of volunteers that have risked their own lives, that wake up 3 o'clock in the morning and leave their families to go help somebody. So let's also recognize the heroism, the acts of courage that has also blossomed in this time. So.
The heroism, the kindness, the food
Thank
distributions.
You.
But there, Sherry, you get an exclusive on the Hipson podcast. Follow Dr. Fauci. There you go. Okay, so Rabbi Jacobson, I really want to thank you. Hopefully this is not going to be the last time. How can the listeners of the podcast connect with you and your books and your writings? I do believe that you have a daily spiritual antidote right now.
Yes. Every day.
I wrote that down. ABC, always be closing.
A daily 3-minute video or podcast that gives you essentially boosts and bolsters your emotional and psychological immunity to counter all the negative. So it's like a soul exercise. And go to meaningfullife.com, meaningfullife.com. One long word, meaningful life, two L's. And there is a wide array of resources of all sorts for all types of audiences. Check it out.
Meaningfullife.com. You can boost your spiritual immune system, not just your physical immune system. I want to thank you.
The ultimate antivirus.
There you go. Thank you so much for your kindness, your wisdom. You never knew that we were mishpacha, but we're actually spiritually related, as we all are.
And, I'm going to call my mother. I'm going to call my mother and tell her we spoke.
Tell her, Ariella from Mill Basin. She knows very well.
I'm sure.
I wish you a happy Mother's Day from me. And hopefully, after this unprecedented time, we can truly, truly go back to a kinder, more gentler world. Sherry, where one hand will wash another. See that? See what I did? You see that? Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice meeting you. Everybody, all be right, well and strong. And keep getting the word out there. Thank you.
Right. God bless you. Thank you. All right. That was great, Sherry.
Yes, it was. Thank you. Well, this has been the Hipson Podcast. Yep.
Sherry, you got to do your bit at the end. Do your bit.
The Hipson Podcast was recorded and produced by Sherry Barkley and Rabbi Simcha. Like and subscribe on iTunes.